he'll be also featured on the program will be John Giorno, who does some audio visual things.
Dial a Poet series. Dial a Poet records.
With acoustic background noises. And so he's a very oral poet. The tickets are on sale at Left Bank in advance, and they're $5. So it's a special program, and you'll want to get your tickets in advance for Burroughs on March 30th.
At Left Bank.
The next dust will be April 13th, and I will be featured with guitarist Becky Boyer and cosmic storyteller Nelson Wu. Before I introduce tonight's guest, I just want to thank some of the people who have worked behind the scenes to help bring these programs to you. There's Michael Castro, who's our treasurer right over here, our door person, Jan Rothschild, our bartender is also our graphic artist for the posters, Leo Bugliacello, and then Karen Duffy, who is so gracious to let us have our programs here, and Carolyn Scott and Peter Carlos, who do the press releases for Dust. So thanks, a big thanks to all of those people who work behind the scenes. James Finnegan, our first poet, was born in Stuttgart, but he considers himself a St. Louisan, and he is in insurance and investment, and he's a businessman poet in the tradition of Wallace Stevens, William Carlos Williams, and A.R. Ammons. And he's read several times with Howard Schwartz, our other featured poet. Howard is, this is Jim's first reading. Okay. Howard is a noted St. Louis author, and he's got numerous books. Two that we have available at our book table are The Captive Soul of the Messiah, which are his parables, and Gathering the Sparks, which are his poetry. He's also the editor of numerous anthologies of mostly Jewish literature. Our musician tonight was supposed to be Lyle Harris, who lives in Columbia, and unfortunately his car broke down, and so he didn't make it here. But we're fortunate to have Bob Abrams, who is a very fine guitarist, and he's also a master craftsman. He makes guitars and banjos. So that's our program tonight. We'll have James and Bob first, then we'll take a short break, and then we'll have Howard come back and read some poems and stories. Thank you very much.
It's always been kind of a dilemma for me to introduce poems because it seems like poem itself should stand on its seems like the poem itself should stand on its merits. Although as a writer, I've found that it's very interesting sometimes to find out a little bit about what the impetus for writing the poem was, or the subtext of it. This first one came out of a trip to Florida a while back, where I did some snorkeling. It's called Hurricane Island. Wind and surf rake sand from this island beach. Our open shirts flutter around suntanned torsos, our wings. Gulls follow our cat path across the beach with envy. Raven after sand crabs and bait fish scared up by the froth and the breaking tide. Bent palms prop up wind-worn beach house that slumps into the dunes. The inrushing waters bemoan the rock and indifference of this coastline. But we are deaf to it now. Underwater, in pulsing chests, our lungs swell as we breathe our own thoughts. Jellyfish are brains loosed from the skulls of ancient mariners, searching to infect other bodies. The sun rolls off the rim of the planet as gulls make disorder of the sky at sunset. The moon shipwrecks among rocks and spills a cargo of stars. We surface only if we remember how to breathe mere air. This next poem came out of an idea I had once that perhaps moths were a little jealous of the position butterflies had in the daylight. Uprising. The plotting began in the high reaches of a swamp pine, with a mutter of wings beating a language of flight. No longer content with the moon and her moods of light, the moths were massing in the cypress grove that encircles the breathing wetlands. Tensely settled, they waited for the dawn. Just before morning, a cold wind, awash from the sea of hills in the distance, melted beneath the threat of light clawing at the rim of the land. The moon sidles away as leaves mourn the end of peace. These night demons will press their fragile wings to the morning air and rise in warmth to the aerial challenge of the butterflies, the sun's angels. At one time I was reading an anthology of Chinese poetry, and I was struck by a particular poem written by a poet who lived about 1000 BC in China. And I think the thing that made me write the poem is that I felt that even though that distance, that time seems great in universal or geological time, it was really almost momentary. So here's the poem. Simple Things, after a poem by Han Yu. Han Yu, is this the same dragonfly that hovered above your man-made pond in China? An insect that flew efficiently before primitive men emerged to divide the land between their horizons. I stand now by a backwater pool, freshly filled by late afternoon rainwater, rain that entreats the growing heat. Wigglers and a thousand other nameless insects stir the water and remind me that it has been 1,000 years since you croaked Chinese at the waterside. You could say, simple things, far better than I, mirror and mock nature in your writing, speaking praise from rhythmic breaths of brackish air. Night descends. I feel it has estranged us. The sun knows the path home and you follow, sunset slung over your shoulder. Miles melt beneath your constant and applied footsteps. When you reach the coast, you will be ferried across the passive sea by the moon, the arc of exotic dreams. In sudden darkness, I remember that the frenzied stars splashing on the water mirror of my pond are the same stars drowning in your pool in Asia. Here's a river poem. Whenever I have a chance to take a ferry rather than cross a bridge, I always decide to take the ferry. Although maybe the piloting the ferry doesn't feel quite the same way. A ferry crossing. In crossing, with the glance of searchlights, you watch, your eyes wade along the sandbars, sluggishly treading down currents. Barge, linked to barge, linked to barge, the yelp of a boatman strangled by fog and the eddies of the channel. Each night, lying close to their mud turrets, the bloated frogs cough up ooze with hollow sounds, and you have forgotten which side of the river you live on. I think among the most difficult poems to deal with are poems about love, whether it be new love or old love or brokenheartedness or whatever it might be. Of course, because it's easy to slip into the modern or the sappy or whatever it might be. Yet, sometimes these poems are most satisfying to write. So, here's one of a few I've attempted. It's called Part Poem. This letter will be my last sonnet. My signature sags beneath the frail lettering, insincerity. Spray-painted hieroglyphics on the flanks of brick buildings, DN plus KL, will last longer than this part poem. After not tying nights, we complain of love undone. In the park of long walks, the statue of some once heroic figure, its stone-hard musculature has gone flabby, the visage unsung and lachrymose. In evening air, snowflakes swirl, ghost kisses skim half-parted lips. Up the stairs to my apartment, I invade a still life. Two wine glasses. A man on the bar waits for the spilling of dice. The wingspread of a half-read magazine. The empty bottle. I drink more. Use drugs more. Chemotherapy for my malignant heart. I'm sure many of the other people who really write find that art is a great thing to tell us to write. And this is a poem entitled, What Monet Knew. Cockcrow at the farmhouse. My half-dead body finds itself washed up on a strange landscape of bed coverings. Heavily I rise to the open window, the outdoors filled with formless color and light. Splotches of sky, the blur of a creek bed running along the pasture, the high grasses daubed with wildflower, trees dripping with mosses strip a gown of darkness from their limbs. Beyond eye reach, the sunrise smolders in a windbreak of skittish poplars. From it, birds fly as sparks to ignite still more of this foreign countryside. My slumberous hands grope along the windowsill, searching for my eyeglasses. I cannot read the illegible lettering of hedgerows. Myopic, I can begin to see what Monet knew. Those of you who know some of my poems know I do a lot of work with city imagery. And this one is also based on a canvas of one of my favorite American artists, Edward Hopper. Nighthawks, after Edward Hopper. Close to the concrete pylons, beneath the high rise, under streetlights hang nighthawks. Wings of a dress flutter around motionless thighs. Shards of pale color swim erratically on pane glass. Flocking around neon light like moths, in cafes perched on swivel stools, they feed on coffee and donuts. Down the alleys of the man-stealing city, into shadowy doorways, over grills that cover dark, breathing sewers, echoing far below, the metallic screeching of subway trains spills onto the pavements. Near daybreak, nighthawks float in circular patterns, searching for roosts under the eaves of rooftops. No refulgent sunrise, only harsh light climbing down rough walls. High on the brick mesa in a window nest, she sighs and stares out over the dim cul-de-sac filled with black drums of trash and torn boxes. Whistling, he follows the night away. It's hard to explain this next poem other than it's one of the poems that kind of tells a little bit of a story, I think. Obvious mirror. Through the night, streets unfold, walls bend inward. Our city collapses unto itself. Overhead, sirens complain of random fire and about crime. Stay afloat, awake. Do not let the undertow of sleep drown you in this fluid darkness. Then dawn, endless ranks of buildings waken, shades draw open, except for the plywood eyelids nailed shut on the dead tenements. The shipyards have closed. Unemployed in working hours, our bodies lag against the stoops along the sidewalk. Boys chip manhole covers into smaller, spendable coins. At the edge of the business district, across the red line and the railroad tracks, corner vendors with pushcarts say, buy what's left, you'll never see it this good again. This could be wartime, and I steal from my own pockets, but nothing of the day is saved. Pigeons maculate a pure sky as I walk home through the spillage of dusk, past excavation sites and under scaffolding where other men have worked. The cat-footed shadows follow me up the stairs to my apartment. Occupants murmur in crypto rooms. There, before a true mirror, I strip clothes and vanity for my body. The lights get turned out. In the harbor, the sun has sunk. A settling flame welds sky to sea along the red seam of the horizon. That is my trade. Life narrows into this room, where my past withered by neglect. Only vegetable shadows overrun these walls. The window is my obvious mirror, and this world a place unreflected. Thus you think everything I do is so somber, really good, a little bit of an upbeat city poem. It's called Metropolitan Rhapsody. The white lacerations of lightning heal quickly. The outrage of a storm passes. A rainbow spans two larger skyscrapers. At nightfall, a multi-complexion populace moves along lamp-lit sidewalks. Horn-mad traffic struggles in cloggy streets. Under balcony bluffs, the exotic waftings of voices, of aromas flow from diners, from dishes. The serpentine queue feeds beneath the marquee. Long trains jounce into the rail yard. Pagan girls make their first farewell of the evening with the furtive kiss of money in their palm. Molten jazz pours from golden instruments, seeps beneath the door of the nightclub. Inside, the graceful bodies of dancers swirl and entwine. It is a midsummer night, warm as gin breath, a night for tuxedos and long open collars. Having run in a street gang while I was a little bit younger, I kind of developed a mythology from that, and this poem reflects that mythology. When the half-gods come. Earth-born, they were cherubs once, fat and homely. They have forgotten the cradle songs, left behind their given names. They have taken sleek nicknames. At street level, their animal voices stream praise through the alleyways. The secular skyscrapers humble the old cathedral, and it kneels. The storefronts are caged at sundown. Shopkeepers have fled by car. Reclaiming the beer hidden in the incorrigible weeds of vacant lots, with tight smiles and cigarettes, they heed only shouts and sirens. Across the lush green of a billiard table, they make slangy dialogue. The balls click, then assume another configuration of color. Outside in the street, all is hand to hand, for the half-gods have come. Ranging through a city without landmarks and of uncertain street signs, superhuman for a few years, they defy anything or anyone, natural or unnatural, to play their extended game. Got to begin this poem with kind of a long-winded disclaimer. Under the heavy influence of some South American poets, I wrote this, and the household that is depicted here in no way reflects my own experience. Okay. Home for the evening. The epigraph is, having the world spring from nothing for no good reason. Nicanor Parra. A midweek night, all the family at home. Outside, it was not rain. The sky itself had liquefied. An electrical storm raged across the table. On the rooftop, the television antenna and the weather vane clashed. In the hour after dinner, all had calmed. My father reads. At around 9, he feels his body shutting down and closes his copy of The Divine Comedy. The TV set explodes. He comes upstairs from the basement with a fire axe, smashes the dining room set, then lashes the pieces together with curtain cord, making a raft or a coffin. Some kind of river craft for the crossing of the Styx. Our dog, a lemur, hangs all night in the rafters. My sister picks up a conch from the bookshelf, holds the shell to her ear for a phone call from Florida. And last week, her boyfriend died. My mother knits herself into a cocoon of hair and yarn. She will emerge before morning as a butterfly or perhaps a wasp. The aquarium boils over. My grandmother, warm in her shawl of silence, rocks eternally. my brother who verges on manhood, tosses his homework and the Bible into the fireplace, takes the shotgun from the closet, and executes his stuffed animals. The floss of their body catches fire upon discharge. The tea kettle screams. It is the rape of the girl that the radio foretold. On the wall, the crucifix reangulates into a swastika. I try to leave this household of nightmares. I struggle for my coat with a kobrak made of human bone. I stay inside. The highway of the river is too far. The piano in the garage revs its pistons, though the night winds down with a clockwork of cigarettes, incense, and ashtray offerings. At midnight, the newspaper that sprawled on the coffee table changes a digit of its date, and once again, the news is current. I slip out of my shoes, each size. My body leadens, I drowse, and fall alone with a dull reverberation into a mattress that remembers the contours and textures of my sleep. I am too old to live at home. In the uterine folds of these blankets, darkness gasifies to smoke, and my dream is a house fire. We'll move to a bit of a rural setting here. This one is called Pastoral. Great paws of unnatural clouds cuff the farmland. A family wanders across stone outcroppings set in slopes of grazing pasture. They scurry away through wire fences while smoke moves in low vapors into haze. The sun is low also. Ponies huddle in the recurved shadows, curling down into basins of grass. Tines of flame engulf the farmhouse, burning as a smaller sun on the horizon. Going back into the city, by the way. This poem has some St. Louis images. Roughfish. Upriver, barges clog the lockage. Throat clearing, the river Mississippi coughs, spits, and rolls over in mud banks. Downstream, at the levee Robert E. Lee designed, a dead roughfish bumps along cobblestones at the waterline. A child pokes it with a stick. His face bulges with the same colorless blurs. A ribcage of stratus clouds heaves the last cool breath of morn. A breeze that rattles the arthritic branches of old trees. On scab pavements, asphalt patched many times, I fix a flat tire on my usual way to work. Some things remembered too often are forgotten. Behind me, the city St. Louis reforms itself. A building erected and one being raised remind me that girders are the bones of cities. A few survivors, unreported by the last census, awaken stiffly from benches chained to lampposts. Around the island park, a motoring sea churns. They say the sunrise has slit its own throat to the knife edge of the horizon. The water purification plant gargles. Sometimes I think of the fish that swim through sunken cars on the river bottom, and my head fills with silt and solace. This is a dream poem. Actually, it's the integration of two dreams. And let's see. The Inlet. The moon concocts a soulless night of shadow, neon, and darkness. On the wharf, fishermen gut the underside of a shark, letting the entrails spill onto the planking. From the pierhead, they roll its body, still alive, into the harbor waters. The same shark is caught again, day later, its body cavity choked with fish it could never digest, always surviving. You walk back into the terrible geometry of this city. Shamblers pass you on the sidewalk, careening against walls and the dead end of the day. Even the clearest mind can never escape the labyrinth of buildings and streets. You step over lumps of half-filled flesh awash on the pavement. their heads filled with the fluid dreams of a wine-colored sea, red as liquid fire. Like in the stockyards, these passageways close off into a chute that narrows into the chamber of the death row. Now you must turn down the last nightmare alley. Sharp-eyed, veins on the temples throb, nostrils flare. Terror is this inlet into which you must now swim, knowing fissures of men wait with shadowy nets you cannot elude. I write very few poems in the setting of suburbia, but this is one of the few. It's called Suburban Guerrilla. Blue splotches, empty swimming pools at midday, green patterns of perfection, shrubbery rows and trim lawns. The sky over the city sags into the steep architecture. Here it is high and bright, flexing at the horizon against the weight of the sun. A sheer white curtain plays ghost in an open window. Children playing in the front yard of a new ranch house are machine gunned to death by the pulsing spray of a sprinkler. The water runs day and night. Okay, two more here. Blurs. The day begins on the highway when the night tears away along the perforated line of streetlights. Clouds hang like old gray laundry, or so the children think. In the park, they confront their shadows with pocket knives. Old men spend their pensionary lives slowly, squinting at the curious winter sun. The estranged men suckle bottles at midday. To them, the sun is a blemish of the sky, and flame. They accost the statue of the statesman in the square, but it has no current answers, and is unperturbed. This woman will sleep throughout the day, hot sands drifting within her head. Each night, the colored sheets rise above her knees, making the tents of a caravan, to stay for the night, then vanish before daybreak. The men inside are never sheiks. This man needs delineation. His face, his identity, washed down the drain as he shaved this morning. He follows the lines and arrows painted on roadways, so his course will not be aimless. An artist has spent his entire day in the park, and his world wisdom smears all that he has painted. The canvas and the surroundings become swirls of color without form. The man and the woman now part. His farewell kisses melt and evaporate the instant they land, last flurries of winter snow. The day ends when afternoon gives way to evening, and dusk frays the edges of everything worn by the day. Then the bodies become blurs. I don't know why I picked this poem to end with, but somehow it seemed appropriate. Rain lament. The night will die heavily upon the land, for the clouds grapple before the storm. From far off, thunder trapens my skullcap, and the dreams flush out, wash away in ravines, muddied and ambiguous. The rain of discontent. Droplets race over the panes and into every fissure and alluvial crack that comprise memory. The afternoon rainstorm destroys the dynasty of the ants. When the sun approaches again, dragging the heat of the day behind it, all I've ever said and read and did becomes vapor.